So those of you who've been with us for a while will know that we've been looking at this book of Genesis, the first book in the Bible, for quite a while. And in the book of Genesis, the first 11 chapters talk about creation, and about flood, and about Tower of Babel, and big picture stuff that affects the whole world. But from chapter 12 onwards, the book of Genesis suddenly zooms in, focuses on one man, and then subsequently his family. That one man is Abraham. Guy called Abraham, who God chose. God spoke to him and called him to go to leave his father's house. But more importantly, God called him into a relationship with himself. So God suddenly starts talking to this guy on a regular basis. And most of the rest of the book of Genesis is the story of God and Abraham, and then God and Abraham's descendants after him, and their relationship. And God made certain promises to Abraham. So right at the beginning, first thing God says to Abraham, says, leave your father's house. And then he says, I'll make you into a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you'll be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. The important thing to know at that point is that Abraham, although married, is getting on a bit, and he has no children. So this promise, I will make you into a great nation, is about having children. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Subsequently, God speaks to him again on another occasion and says, I will make you very fruitful. I will make nations of you, and kings will come from you. And then God gets more specific and says, your wife Sarah will bear you a son, and you will call him Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. So God says to Abraham, who by various means and by different women has more than one child, he says it's through Isaac. Isaac is the one that's chosen. He's the one that is through him as your descendant and through his descendants that I'm going to bless all the peoples on the earth. Again, God says to Abraham, I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, this is when Abraham goes to sacrifice Isaac, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me. So, the first passage, it says, all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. This one, it becomes clearer. Your descendants are going to be vast in number, and it's through your offspring, through your descendants, that all the nations on the earth will be blessed because you've obeyed me. Abraham has the son, Isaac, through whom to whom the promise is repeated. And then Isaac has two sons, Jacob and Esau, or Esau and Jacob, technically, as Esau is the elder. And God speaks to Jacob. And we studied this late last year, that while Jacob was having a dream, God speaks to Jacob and says, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the sea and to the east, to the north, to the south. Start the west somewhere. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. So the promise is still future. It's still about offspring. But this is God's, the repeated theme. Hopefully you've got the picture. This is the theme of the book of Genesis, that through Abraham and his descendants, through Isaac, through Jacob's descendants, all the peoples on the earth will be blessed. And that's the big theme of this book of Genesis. And in the last few weeks, we've looked at the life of Jacob. An interesting and fairly dodgy character. And Jacob was a man who had lots of family. So initially, this Abraham's descendants seemed a bit tenuous. He had just the one son, Isaac, who was the son of Abraham and Sarah. But by the time we get to Jacob, they're starting to multiply, and you begin to see how it's possible that a great nation will come from Abraham's descendants. And last week, we started looking at the story of Joseph. Joseph is a very familiar story. Andrew Lloyd Webber has written musicals about him, so he must be significant. And we looked at the story of Joseph's Joseph as a young man, the dreams he had, and his relationship with his brothers wasn't great, so that his brothers hated him. And we got to the bit in the life of Jacob where he was his brothers took him, and they initially they put him in a big pit and they were going to kill him. And then subsequently they decided, rather than kill him, let's sell him, get some money out of him. And so they sold Jacob to slave traders. And the slave traders were on their way from Palestine to Egypt. And Joseph was taken away by the slave traders to disappear into obscurity as a slave in Egypt. And if you know the story of the musical, or even better, the story of the Bible, you'll know that there's a lot more to come in Joseph's story. And you'll know that many quite exciting things happen to Joseph. And we'll look at those in the next few weeks. But this chapter that we've read isn't about Joseph. Instead, we suddenly take what feels like a digression. Last chapter, all about Joseph. Next chapter, all about Joseph. But this chapter, as you've heard, because you've read it, is about one of his older brothers, this guy Judah. I don't think that's an accurate likeness, but you get the picture. He was the fourth of Jacob's sons. So why have we taken this sudden veering away from the story of Joseph and a turn into the story of Jacob? Not Jacob, Judah. Well, there's probably there are a number of reasons. One is that I guess it's a true story that the author thought it was worth recording. I think also it's a useful literary device. It's a way of making us understand in the story of Joseph just how long it took. You know the story of Joseph, you can go and see it in a musical on the stage, it probably takes about 2.5-3 hours. But all of this chapter that we read, sons being born, growing up, being old enough to have their own wives and produce children, all of that happens while Joseph has just disappeared into obscurity. It didn't take 2.5-3 hours in Joseph's life, it took years. And this chapter here, it helps to heighten the tension, I guess. Joseph was clearly the favoured son. Joseph was the guy who had the dreams. And he suddenly disappeared. And he's sold into slavery and he disappears. And all the time you're reading chapter 38, who knows what's happened to Joseph? Where did he go? What happened to him? So we come to the chapter itself. This is the story of Judah. And who's Judah? Well, we don't know that much about Judah prior to this. But Judah is the fourth of the brothers, of the sons of Jacob. If you look at them, Reuben is the eldest, this one here. Reuben had already blotted his copybook in sleeping with one of his father's wives, not his own mother, but one of his father's wives, which had sort of put him in the doghouse initially. Simeon and Levi, we talked about them a few weeks ago. They were the guys who were responsible for the for killing all the men in the town of Shechem after an episode involving Jacob's daughter, Dinah. And Jacob was pretty upset with them, said, "You've brought me into disgrace. Now everyone will hate me because you've killed all these people." So in a way, Judah, we've come to, this is Judah's turn to be on center stage. And Judah does feature. Last week, we looked at the story of Joseph being sold into slavery, and Judah does have I'm not sure it's a starring role, but he does have a part to play in that story. He's mentioned by name, because when they stick Joseph in a pit, these brothers, and they say, "We'll kill him later." Or actually, they're planning to kill him. And Reuben the eldest says, let's put him in a pit, and then we can sort him out later. And because Reuben's plan is to come back and rescue him. While Reuben isn't there, Judah says to his brothers, what will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood. And his brothers agreed. Well, I guess you can say, at least you can say this for Judah, that he feels that, you know, he owes this much to his brother, not to kill him. But selling him into slavery isn't that great as an alternative. I think you'd agree. Judah is a man who's out for money. What will we gain if we kill our brother? It's not what will we lose, what will happen to us, what's the downside. It's what will we gain. There's nothing in it for us. But let's sell him. Let's make some money. I don't think this is exactly mercy at work. This is greed. So Judah, in the single thing that we kind of hear about him before chapter 38, he's not that likable a character. When we get to chapter 38, and we find that right at the start, at that time Judah left his brothers, went down to stay with a man of Adullam named Hiram. There Judah met the daughter of a Canaanite man named Shua. He married her. So Judah had left his brothers, he'd left the people that were God's people, and he'd gone off to live with some of the locals, with the Canaanites. And he marries a Canaanite. Now, if you're familiar, you may remember, or you may not, that in the story of Genesis previously, we've had a couple of references to marrying Canaanites. And it's pretty clear from the book of Genesis, it's not a thing, and not a good thing to do. This is not behavior that's encouraged. This is what Abraham says when he's old and he needs a wife. He needs to find a wife for his son, Isaac. And he says to his servant, you've got to go and find a wife for my son. And he says to the servant, I want you to swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not get a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I am living, but will go to my country and my own relatives and get a wife for my son Isaac. Marrying Canaanites, you read that, you think, well, maybe not the best thing to do. A generation later, Isaac called for Jacob and blessed him. Then he commanded him, do not marry a Canaanite woman. Go at once to Paddan Aram, to the house of your mother's father, Bethuel. Take a wife for yourself there from among the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. It's pretty clear. Marrying Canaanites is a no-no. It's a thing to be avoided at all costs. But Judah doesn't seem interested in that. He sees this woman. She doesn't even have a name. She's just the daughter of a man called Shua. And he marries her. And he has three children by her. And as events work through, Judah doesn't become really much more likable. Because as you've heard, because we've read it, Judah loses two of his sons. But he's not exactly prostrated with grief at the loss of his sons. He loses his firstborn son and his second son. They both die. And Judah doesn't seem too bothered, to be honest. And that stands out because there's a contrast with the end of the chapter before. The end of chapter 37, the brothers tell Jacob, well, we found these clothes. Look like they could be Joseph's. They've got blood on them. We don't know where he is. Probably a wild animal killed him. And Jacob is inconsolable at the loss of his son. Judah, well, not so much. It does mention that he grieves for his wife, actually, but not for his sons. And then we come to the really strange bit. So Judah has these sons. The sons themselves grow up. And the eldest is of age to marry himself. Probably in those days could be his late teens. So time is passing here. A lot of time is passing. And remember, all this time, Joseph is a slave in Egypt because of Judah's intervention. Judah's growing older with his family, growing up around him. And his eldest son, with the fantastic name of Ur, is who must have turned his head every time anyone hesitated in speech, thinking they were talking to him. Ur is old enough to get married. Judah finds him a wife, another Canaanite girl called Tamar. And then we have this strange line. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the Lord's sight, and the Lord put him to death. We don't know what Ur did. We don't know what was wrong, what it was. We have no idea. It doesn't tell us anything at all. But Ur died. And what happens next? Well, there was a custom in the ancient Near East called levirate marriage. And it's worth just taking a minute to understand this, because otherwise the story looks really bizarre, and because this is the kind of the crux of the story. So what happened in the ancient world was, if you died, if a man and a woman were married and the husband died, then the husband's brother, sorry, if they died and they were childless, the husband's brother had a duty to sleep with the widow and hopefully father children or a child. There is an explanation here, or sort of an explanation, but in Deuteronomy, which is obviously a bit later on, but Moses tells the Israelites, he's giving them a huge long list of laws. These are the rules for our society. This is what we do. This is how we structure ourselves. This is bad behavior. This is good behavior. This is, and he says in Deuteronomy 25, he sets out a bit about this. That if brothers are living together, and one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside the family. Her husband's brother shall take her and marry her, and fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to her. The firstborn son she bears shall carry on the name of the dead brother, so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. Now that sounds, I think, to most of us, pretty bizarre. I suspect that there is a risk at this point of losing you all as you all mentally think about your brother-in-law or sister-in-law, but let's not go there. That's not what we're here to talk about. In our society, this is indeed very bizarre behaviour, but I learnt yesterday from Wikipedia that actually levirate marriage still exists in quite a few parts of the world. It still continues. And certainly in the ancient world of its time, this was not something that was unique to this particular tribe or religion. This wasn't just the Jews that did this, the Israelites. This was common in societies around them. And there's kind of two reasons, I guess. There's the one that's clear here, so that the name of the elder brother, the brother, carries on. Because it was important that you had descendants, that you had children. And so, if you didn't have any of your own, in a way, your brother had to supply them for you, so that your name will not be blotted out from Israel. Because this was something really significant. And in the past, we've seen this elsewhere in the book of Ruth, particularly. It's another story in the Bible that hinges on this whole concept. So it's about making sure that the brother who's died, that his name isn't forgotten. He doesn't disappear. His line doesn't just disappear and stop. His name is not blotted out from Israel. But it also has another, I guess, more practical purpose. Because if a man and a woman are married, and the man dies, and they're childless, the lookout for the widow is pretty grim. Who's going to provide for her in her old age? In a society with no state pension, her own family are not going to want anything more to do with her. In a way, they kind of shipped her off at the point of her marriage, and have no further responsibility towards her. So this is about carrying on the family line, maintaining the name, but it's also about providing for widows, providing for people who would otherwise be at risk of starving. And again, the Book of Ruth really sets out this in some detail. It's a story about a widow and the situation, and you see how fragile life is for a widow, or was for a widow, in Israel. So the formatting's gone wrong, but just to make it clear, there was Judah. He married this woman who is never dignified with a name, but is merely the daughter of Shua. And they have three sons together, Ur, Onan, Shelah. And Judah procures a wife for Ur, this lady Tamar. Ur, we don't know what he did, but he does something wrong. He's judged by God and he dies. And so Tamar becomes Onan's. Onan's, I was going to say problem, but opportunity, whatever you want to call it. But Tamar becomes Onan's wife. But Onan, we're told, you've heard the passage, that Onan resorts to basic methods of contraception to avoid getting her pregnant. Why does he do that? Well, it's not entirely clear, but what is clear is that Onan is not prepared to do his duty. If he does his duty, Tamar becomes pregnant, the child, any child resulting from that union, would be Ur's child, not his. It's worth noting that in the ancient world, the firstborn son got a kind of double share of the inheritance. Ur's gone. Onan's the firstborn. He's going to get the double share. But if Ur has a child, Ur obviously himself can't have a child, but if Onan supplies a child for Ur, then guess who gets the double share of the inheritance? The child, which is then goes through Ur's family line, not Onan's. So maybe Onan has learned from his father that money is the main thing. Maybe he just doesn't care about his responsibilities, his responsibility to the community, his responsibility to Tamar, his responsibility to his brother. We don't know exactly. I think there's probably both, that he fancies the money and he's just not that interested in his responsibilities to others. And so, though he sleeps with Tamar regularly, and it is, the original language is explicit, that this isn't a once or twice thing. He sleeps with her on a regular basis, but every time he removes himself at the crucial moment, and therefore no child is born. And this behaviour angers God, and God passes judgment on Onan. Onan dies too. So, by rights, by law, by the custom of that society, Tamar will be moving on to Shelah. But Shelah, being the youngest, is deemed a bit too young to marry yet. So Judah says, go home, live with your father for a bit, and when he's a bit older, I'll give you to Shelah. But it's recorded here, the subtext. What Judah says out loud to Tamar is, you'll get Shelah in due time. What he says in his head is, this woman is bad news. I've just lost two sons to her. She ain't going near Shelah. In Judah's head, it's clearly not his son's fault. It must be Tamar that's the problem, not the men. Fairly common theme in society ever since, I guess. And so Tamar is shipped off to her father's house, and Judah decides he wants nothing more to do with her. And so then comes this odd story where Tamar dresses up, covers her face, or takes off her widow's clothes, dresses up with a veil so she can't be seen. Her face can't be seen, she can't be recognized, which apparently was characteristic of prostitutes of the day, and goes and sits by the road. Again, what does this tell us about Judah? Judah's just lost his wife by this stage. So some time has passed between Onan dying and this event. Shelah has grown up, and Tamar has realized that Judah has no intention of letting her anywhere near him. Judah's own wife has died. And Tamar's plan is to dress as a prostitute and sit by the road when Judah goes past. Now, you might think that's a bit hit and miss as a plan. Because, you know, lots of people walk past prostitutes. They don't necessarily stop. Presumably Tamar thinks that she has a pretty good chance that Judah will stop. It does tell you, I think, something else about Judah, that Tamar thought that dressing as a prostitute and sitting by the side of a road he was going to walk past gave her a pretty good chance of interaction with him. This is Judah. Clearly, it probably wasn't the first time he'd been with a prostitute. And then you have the encounter that's recorded. There's no beating about the bush here. There's no niceties. He goes to her and says, come now, let me sleep with you. And she is equally blunt and straightforward and says, well, what are you going to give me? And the story develops as we've read. She demands a proof that he will pay her in due course. He will send the goat that they agree is the price. So she takes his seal, which is kind of, it's like taking his ID, really. Taking his passport, maybe, or his credit card, or something really important. She's taken something that is absolutely tied to him, to Judah, and is something that's really important that he's going to want back. And in due course, as we've read, so they sleep together, in due course, she gets pregnant, and in due course, 3 months later, Judah is told, well, according to the translation we have here, it says, your daughter-in-law Tamar is guilty of prostitution, and as a result, she's now pregnant. I think she's accused of promiscuity, probably, rather than prostitution. It doesn't really matter. She's got pregnant. It's not about a specific type of sexual activity that's got her pregnant. It's about that she's got pregnant. She's been sleeping with someone when she shouldn't have been. She should have been waiting for Sheila, who she was never going to be introduced to. And Judah is interesting here. Judah is a man who we've seen already. Judah is a man who sold his brother into slavery without a backward glance. Judah is a man who has no time, really no interest in hanging out or living with God's people, with his brothers, his family, but goes off to immerse himself in Canaanite society. Judah is a man who immerses himself to the extent that he marries Canaanites and finds Canaanite wives for his children, despite the fact that he would have been pretty clear that was frowned on by his ancestors. Judah is a man who, his daughter-in-law knows that dressing as a prostitute is a pretty surefire way of getting into bed with him. And at this point, Judah comes over suddenly all outraged. So his Tamar is pregnant. Judah knows that he's never let her anywhere near Sheila, and she shouldn't have been sleeping with anyone else. So Judah, the man who sold his brother, who sleeps with prostitutes, Judah is morally outraged and says, let him be burnt to death. Which, even by the standards of the day, which were not quite the same as ours, was pretty harsh. That was reserved for extreme cases, burning someone to death. But Judah, that's what Judah says should happen to her. And I guess, in a way, for Judah, that'll solve a nice little problem. Tie up a loose end or two and get rid of her. Then he can find a new wife for Sheila and everything. He can forget that Tamar ever existed. And of course, in this fantastic scene, the drama is as she was being brought out. She doesn't act immediately to nip this in the bud at an early stage. It's as she's being brought out to be burnt. You can see, you know, the guys sort of stacking the wood and the fire being lit, and they, as she's being brought out, in the nick of time, she suddenly produces the seal, produces effectively Judah's passport, says, recognize this? Judah recognizes him and says, she's more righteous than I. Tamar doesn't get burnt. It's not clear exactly what happens. It says Judah has no continuing relationship with Tamar. Does she get given to Sheila? Possibly not. She already has children. She's pregnant. She's already going to have children. So where does this leave us? What kind of mess is this? I mean, this is, even by the standards of the Old Testament, which has some fairly interesting corners, this is a screwed up story. Surely. a woman being passed from brother to brother, ending up sleeping with her father-in-law, who thinks she's a prostitute at the time, his response to want to burn her to death. Is this the stuff that we want to learn from? Is this what we're going to take to heart? Are there role models in this story? What do we do with it? Where do we go? That isn't the Greenwich Foot Tunnel, just in case you're wondering. What do we learn from the story? So first of all, we learn that this is a messed up world. It is, I think, this story is probably genuinely fairly shocking. But it's not so different from the lives of lots of people in our society. We probably know people whose relationships are almost as tangled as this. This is a messed up world we're living in, where strange things happen. Relationships break down. People don't honour their commitments. So first of all, this is a story. This is a realistic story. This isn't a story of this isn't a Garden of Eden. Everything's wonderful. Everything's rosy. Isn't everything great? This is a recognition that this is a messed up world. And I think all of us know that we live in a messed up world. But in a messed up world, what's important here? The first thing is that God looks out for the vulnerable. Look at the two characters, the two main characters in the story. And you've got Judah, who's a wealthy man, who after his three elder brothers had kind of blotted their copybook, is in some ways the leader of a growing and increasingly powerful tribe. Judah is a man, which is always was in those days absolutely massively a better position to be in. Everything was on his side, and Tamar was a Canaanite, despised by the Israelites. Tamar was a woman. There was no equality, no semblance, no nothing like equality in that society. And Tamar was his daughter-in-law. In a society, a very sort of hierarchical society, she's at a disadvantage on from every single angle. Wherever you turn, Tamar's nothing. She's nobody. And Judah, all the cards are in Judah's hands. This is not an equal relationship. It's not an equal contest between the two of them. The dice are loaded. Everything is on his side and not hers. And yet, in the end, this does work out for Tamar. She does get the child that she so desperately wants, and that she needs. Tamar is the one who is vulnerable. Without a husband, without any children, she's the one facing a scary old age. But God's law protects her. We read the passage from Deuteronomy where he sets out these same rules. This is God's law protects her, and she is able to assert her rights and to provide for her old age, because God's law protects the vulnerable. And not only that, not only does God have laws that protect the vulnerable, but you can see, if you read on through the Bible, that what Tamar does is it's actually celebrated. Now there is a question here, which commentators, the experts who write the books on this stuff, they differ on this. Was what Tamar did right or wrong? There were long threads on the internet devoted to discussing the question. When Judah says she is more righteous than I, this is the beginning of a long discussion on the internet. So, well, are either of them righteous? How can either of them call themselves righteous? But it is possible. I think it's a reasonable interpretation of this whole levirate marriage thing. Judah's responsibility, it was Judah's responsibility to find her a husband. You remember in the chapter, it's Judah that gives his second son to Tamar. It's not the second son, it's not like in Deuteronomy where it's described that the brother should take on the responsibility. It's Judah's responsibility to find the new husband for Tamar. There's no kind of genetic issues with the fact that she slept with her father-in-law. Marrying your father-in-law is forbidden in the law, later on in Leviticus. But so is marrying your brother's wife. Sorry. So did she do anything wrong? She transferred the levirate marriage concept. Instead of going to his brother, her husband's brother, she went to his father. And there's nothing that says that is necessarily the wrong answer. So bizarre as it looks, if you put yourself back into that society, if you put yourself back into that era, did Tamar do anything wrong? Probably not. Because Tamar is celebrated. When you read on, you read the book of Ruth. And if you're familiar with the book of Ruth, you may remember that Naomi is a widow without children. And in the end, she has, well, her daughter-in-law, Ruth, has a son. And the people of the town say to Naomi, the elders of the people say, to Boaz and to Ruth, they say, through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. This isn't a disgrace that's covered up. This is a blessing that the people, the elders of the town, are giving to Boaz, whom Tamar bore to Judah. So God looks out for the vulnerable. His laws protect them. But also, what she did is celebrated. Tamar is regarded as a model, in a way. And I think that shows that as the people of Israel, as they meditated on this passage, as they thought about it, they recognized that Tamar, that God had provided for Tamar. God looked after her. So in a messed up world, God looks out for the vulnerable. In a messed up world, God is working in Judah. Now, I admit that this is a bit, there's not much in this passage that shows that. Judah starts off as a guy who's gone off to live with the Canaanites and immerse himself in their society. And although he is dissuaded, or he's persuaded not to burn his daughter-in-law, we don't see any radical transformation in Judah. But in a few weeks' time, we'll be coming on to a passage where, and I don't think I'm giving away too much, because I think most of you are probably familiar with the story of Joseph. When Joseph is the ruler of Egypt, and he says, and his brothers have gone down there to buy grain, they don't recognize him, and Joseph says, you can have the grain, but I want to keep one of you brothers with me as a hostage. And that will be Benjamin. And what happens then? Judah steps up. Judah, the guy who's previously motivated by money and motivated by his own interest, Judah says, please don't do this. You'll bring my father to the grave. Let me stay and let the boy go. Judah, the guy who said, why don't we sell Joseph into slavery? Is the guy who volunteers himself, effectively, to go into captivity so that his youngest brother, Benjamin, can go back to his father. Somewhere between chapter 37 and chapter whatever that is, a few chapters' time, Judah changes radically. Nothing else is recorded about Judah except this chapter. And I don't know. We don't know for certain. But maybe this episode where he's confronted with his own morality, let her burn, but his own deceitfulness. Maybe that's what starts the change in Judah. God is working in Judah, because Judah, by the time we get a few chapters further on, is a very different man. And then Most importantly of all, in a messed up world, God has a plan for good. We started this by looking at all those promises to Abraham, that through you or through your descendants, all the peoples of the earth will be blessed. Tamar appears in one other place in the Bible. She's referred to in Ruth as part of the blessing of the elders give to Boaz. But she's also in the New Testament, right at the start of the New Testament, in the book of Matthew, in chapter 1, where the line, the genealogy, the family tree of Jesus is set out. And there, in that family tree, we find Tamar again. It starts with Abraham, the father of Isaac, Isaac, the father of Jacob, Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers, Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. There's only about three or four women mentioned in that family tree of Jesus, and Tamar is one of them. So in all this messed upness, in all the peculiarity and bizarreness of this situation, God is building a family tree, laying out a family tree that leads to Jesus, who ultimately is God's answer for a messed up world. It's amazing, isn't it? It feels wrong in a way. Surely Jesus should have come from through the good guys. And there are good guys, or at least some of the heroes of the Old Testament, do feature in Jesus' family tree. David's in there. Boaz, who we mentioned earlier. They're in there. But so are the messed up people. So are the people whose lives are really screwed up. Judah, this guy who sold his brother as a slave, who immersed himself in a pagan culture, Judah becomes the ancestor of Jesus. And Judah, not just Judah, not just in the normal ways, the normal family relationship, but Judah through sleeping with his daughter-in-law. How screwed up is that? But it's through that mess, that ultimately Jesus is born. The promise to Abraham, through you, all the peoples of the earth will be blessed. So what do we do? What do we take away from this? What can we learn? Is there anything to celebrate here, or is it just mess, weirdness, and a culture that's totally alien? Well, there is something to celebrate. Because actually, Tamar is celebrated in the book of Ruth and in the book of Matthew. God is looking out for the vulnerable. I don't know if anyone here feels that they are invulnerable. Anyone here feels that nothing can hurt them, nothing can go wrong. I doubt it. We are all of us only too aware that there's so much in our lives that could go wrong. And that's us living in a wealthy and relatively stable country. The fact that God is concerned for the weak, for the downtrodden, for the outcast, for the outsider, that's good news. Because any of us can find ourselves in that situation. The fact that God has a plan for good, that God had a saviour for this world, one who ultimately would deal with all of the messed upness, the screwed upness, by taking the price of it, the punishment, on himself on the cross. That's good news. But also that God works in individuals. Here's Judah, a man who wants money more than he wants a brother, a man who wants nothing to do with God, but goes to live in a pagan Canaanite town, away from anyone else who knows about God. Here's Judah, a man who appears as a prostitution habit. But God has a plan for him. God works not just in the big picture, in all peoples of the earth, not just in some great scheme, but God works in individuals. And he transforms Judah. And Judah, by the end of his story, as we find it, the bits of it that are recorded, is a very different Judah from the one that I've introduced you to here this morning. And that can be you this morning, if it hasn't been already. God offers that change. He offers forgiveness. He offers transformation through the Jesus who is Judah's descendant. So if you've never experienced that, if you've never found him for yourself, then that's what you need most this morning. Whether you feel vulnerable or you don't feel vulnerable, trust me, you are. God makes a difference. God works in the broken people, in the vulnerable people, in the hard-hearted people, in you and in me. God works to change us through Judah's descendant, Jesus. So if you've never met him, if you don't have a relationship with him, then make sure you do this morning. Don't leave it here.